Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to stay on top of all the latest news from China in only a few minutes a day through our email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, or at the website subchina.com. SubChina offers uncensored reporting all about China, and you can read about everything from media policy to the Me Too movement, from the Belt and Road Initiative to China's ongoing draconian repression of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. We are sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm in Washington, D.C. today. Joining me from the rustic splendor of Goldcorn Holler is a man whose head-turning physical beauty really puts the 10 in Tennessee, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn, editor-in-chief of SubChina. Jeremy, yeah, beauty, greet the people, won't you?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's nobody around who can see me to say the truth that I am not putting the 10 in Tennessee. But anyway, thank you.
Well, I mean, to me, you will always be beautiful. In the last show, we spoke with Julian Ku about some of the legal questions around Canada's arrest at the behest of the U.S. of Meng Wanzhou, who is CFO, of course, of Chinese telecommunications equipment giant Huawei and the daughter of its founder, Ren Zhengfei.
This week, we're going to look at the technological and national security dimensions of this, and of course at the geopolitics. We'll talk about what's at stake in this move by Washington, what the motives might be, and what actual threats Huawei might pose.
Joining us to sort through all these issues at the nexus of technology, security, and politics are two of the best in the business. First, we have Sam Sachs, cybersecurity policy and digital China economy fellow at New America, which some of you probably still know by its former moniker, the New America Foundation. Sam was formerly at CSIS. I've had the great pleasure of sharing a couple of panels with her recently, and her insights and things tech are just fantastic. So Sam, welcome to Cynica.
Thanks so much.
Also joining us is Paul Triolo, practice head in geotechnology at the Eurasia Group. Paul is an outspoken and deeply knowledgeable observer of China's tech scene, and we're very proud to say columnist for SubChina. A very warm welcome to Cynica, Paul.
Thank you. I'm really honored to finally be on the podcast. I really have enjoyed it listening to it over the past few months.
Oh, wonderful. Great. Well, anyway, I'm going to cut to the chase here. Is it fair to say that bank fraud, violation of Iran sanctions, or whatever else Huawei or its CFO might have perpetrated are actually secondary here, and that there's something else that's really at stake, something else that's the real issue? Couldn't you argue that one bigger issue is simply Huawei itself, namely that the U.S. and increasingly at the insistence of the U.S., its allies, just don't trust the company? They believe its ties to the Chinese Communist Party run really deep, and they just want to see the company on its knees or even completely supine with a minimum footprint in telecom, and especially in the very sensitive new 5G networks. Or couldn't you even argue that it's not just Huawei, that it's China, really, and that Huawei is just kind of proxy for Beijing in American thinking? I mean, I thought that was pretty clear in the reporting about, you know, the Five Eyes meeting in Nova Scotia, for example.
Kaiser, great question. So yeah, I think, you know, the sort of looking at this the short term issue. Yes, I mean there was the arrest of Meng in Vancouver in and of itself was a fairly unprecedented move on the U.S. part, but it certainly comes amidst a long history of U.S. concerns about Huawei as a company. So the fact that she was involved appears to have been involved in violating Iran sanctions is sort of almost a secondary issue to the U.S. concern over Huawei as a company, and this goes back at least a decade. And I think it's come to the fore now primarily because of the 5G networks that you mentioned, because the stakes are much higher now.
Sam, what do you think?
People have had it out for Huawei for years, but now there's a platform for that. And I think we're in a climate now where there's sort of an unrestrained environment to go after Huawei, or Huawei, as I've heard for years, people refer to it as Huawei. It's just really come to represent something so much more than a company. It's this sort of everything that we fear about China's technological and cyber capabilities is now represented by Huawei.
Yeah, absolutely.
Paul, can you give us some context here? We're talking about 5G networks, but can we spend a few minutes to make sure that our listeners and I understand what exactly 5G is and what's at stake here? How transformative is 5G likely to be? When are we all going to be on 5G the way we're all pretty much now on 4G? And are there projections about how much capital expenditure we're talking about in major markets? How much is at stake in terms of money?
Well, it's a complicated issue, Jeremy, and a huge and important issue. So 5G is really, I would say, much more transformative than the shift from 3G to 4G, because the difference with 5G that also gets back to some of these security concerns is that it's going to be much more than your phone having a better ability to stream live high-definition video at a football game. The real transformative portion of 5G are the two out of the three secondary parts of 5G. The first part is updating the speed of mobile networks in general for consumers. But the other two parts involving ultra-reliable and low latency communications and massive machine-to-machine communications, this is the jargon of 5G, those are specifically about machine-to-machine communications. So think of things like autonomous vehicles, smart factories with robots communicating with infrastructure. Think about VR, AR, and all sorts of other applications that they're going to run on top of.
So, sorry, what is VR, AR?
Virtual reality and augmented reality. So you.
Oh, VR, AR. Yeah,
sorry,
okay.
Sorry for the jargon. There's a lot of jargon in 5G, which I'll try to avoid. But so 5G is going to roll out over a period of time. So that also gets, we can relate this back to the Huawei problem, because it's going to be very expensive, because those second two pieces of the network involve a tremendous amount of capital investment. And so the first part can be built on existing networks. So as we think about, you know, who's going to develop 5G, Huawei has moved into this position where it's almost unique among the major players globally, and that it can produce all elements of 5G, from handsets to data centers, you know, and everything in between. So that's why Huawei is important. But the transformative nature of this also means more data running around on the network, and it means many more connected devices, and it means, you know, critical infrastructure data flying around on 5G, which hasn't really been the case so much with 4G. So this gets back to why people are concerned about 5G: more data, more devices, all the applications built on top of it, which will also generate economic benefits, for example. So it really is transformative.
That was pretty impressively jargon-free, I thought. Pretty intelligible.
The one word I still... Can you explain latency? Because that always comes up when we hear speeds. How do you explain latency?
Latency is the time it takes for a particular... You know, when you click your mouse, for something to actually happen. So the key is that with 4G, there's a lot of latency problems in the network. So if you're going to have, for example, autonomous vehicles communicating in real time with data centers or amongst themselves to avoid collisions and accidents, you need a very reliable system that has very minimal latency, so that when a car reacts to something, it can do that almost instantaneously. And the current systems don't allow that. So that's why you have to build out and push out infrastructure closer to things like highways and buildings, so you get that latency down, and you can run some of those really high-end applications like autonomous vehicles.
Sam, I guess you don't play network video games. I know what latency is.
No.
It is a little bit jargony. Yeah.
Maybe what Sam, you can do, though, is explain some of Huawei's capabilities in 5G. I mean, Paul mentioned that they can sort of do end-to-end. Are we seeing China, through companies like Huawei, trying to push an actual standard? I mean, way back when we were rolling out, it was still in the era of 2G and getting ready to roll out 3, China Mobile got saddled with this sort of indigenously developed standard called TD-SCDMA. I remember writing a lot about that, and I think it was like, are they now rolling out a similar Chinese standard, or are they looking just for a seat at the table? Where are they in terms of participation in standard setting?
So one of the things that we hear a lot is Huawei is looking to have a bigger seat at the table or a voice in international standards setting around 5G. So let's break that down a bit and sort of talk about what's going on there. It's true. We've heard major statements come out from senior leadership in China talking about this concept of having the term is a right to speak. And that's something that Paul and I and others have translated and talked about. And they are sending more representatives to the international bodies that are actually hammering out standards. What do we mean by a standard? These are the technical specifications, which are going to determine a lot. There's going to be commercial gains that's going to come from it. One of the things that I think we need to distinguish, though, is yes, Huawei and other Chinese companies definitely are exercising more influence in these international standards bodies. But what does that mean? What's the consequence of it? And I think sometimes this consequence gets blurred. So does that mean that they are going to use their influence in international standards setting around 5G to create more areas that can be hacked into, that can be exploited for military, for intelligence purposes? Or does that mean that they are going to have a commercial advantage that comes with that? And those are two very separate issues. And I think that, and Paul, I'd love to have you weigh in on this as well. I think that our view has been that it's more of a commercial advantage that comes from that. You know, these working groups, they're very technical, right? And if you talk to people that sit in the working groups, this is not a process that's necessarily open to having people show up and have a political agenda, right? These are engineers hammering out technical details, and they have to, it works by consensus. So is that subject to sort of political influence? I would say no, but Paul would love your thoughts on that too.
Yeah, Paul, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, what's driving this is, you know, is really the issue of royalties. So in 4G, 3G and 4G, there were no real major Chinese players that were able to establish standard essential patents and be part of sort of the patent pool that exists around these kinds of technologies. So they're paying a lot of money to Qualcomm, for example, which is the U.S. leader in 4G, has been and will lead in 5G. So Huawei has, with Chinese government backing, has devoted a tremendous amount of money to R&D, research and development of technologies that are going to be critical to 5G. So at the standards bodies, there's a rule that you have to bring your intellectual property there, and then sort of the best technical solution wins.
Right.
It's a very politically free process, because the goal is to get the best quality technology, and companies come there and they basically pony up their intellectual property for others to see. And then it's really a merit-based system. And Huawei has learned to play this game very well. But they also, to play the game, you have to have done the R&D and bring things to the table. So really think about standards as a recipe. So the 3GPP body, this is a body that sets the standards. They come up with a recipe. Here's the best technology for the recipe for 5G. And then anybody can build to that recipe. So the recipe is a separate thing. And then the recipe is based on what are called standard essential patents. And so there is an economic piece of that. But what happens is if companies are building the equipment, you know, it's in a patent pool. And so there's some offsetting patents. And so yeah, Huawei will gain some commercial advantage in this in terms of the patents, but Qualcomm and Broadcom and Intel and a lot of other companies, and Ericsson and Nokia in the EU, are also going to get patents to own patents. So it's a very global process, and it's actually kind of a really interesting 5G. It's like this. It's probably the most global and participatory standard setting process that's ever happened, the most complex one, because there's so many new pieces of 5G, for example, compared to 4G. So
these bodies, are we talking about like the ITU?
Well, no, the ITU. The ITU sort of sets the parameters. This ITU sets the requirements. So what is the latency? And then 3GPP, it started with 3GPP.
Right.
3GPP is the body that sets the standards. And they have subgroups that work on different pieces of the network, the core of the network, the radio part of the network, and the cyber and the security part of the network. So for example, Huawei is on many of the committees, the subcommittees, and ZTE also, that are setting these standards. And from what we understand, Huawei gets very high marks on the security side, ironically. for bringing good solutions on the security side. So they're very much a player within the industry groups that are all, these are all companies that are bringing their intellectual property and their expertise to the table. So they're very much a player.
Yeah, I've actually heard that on the working group that's focused on cybersecurity, Huawei has been a better partner and sort of has more to offer on the cybersecurity front than other companies from some of the other participating countries. You know, however you want to interpret that, that's what, you know, we've had some conversations around that, which is interesting.
Okay, so Paul and Sam, and maybe we can start with Sam. Who is driving the American animosity to Huawei? Is it coming from a particular interest group, a group of lawmakers, the intelligence community, the Department of Defense, or has everyone just converged of on Huawei as an obvious avatar for the rising Chinese technology threat, perfect with its chairman who basically lives in a bat cave and refuses to speak to the media. Sam, perhaps you could answer first.
Paul, do you want to take start at that and I'll chime in?
Sure, if that's okay. So I think, the concerns around Huawei, again, go back for a long time. And part of it started about the concern about their business practices. So in the early days, it was about, were they pirating Cisco software and then repurposing that? So there's a long-standing sense that Huawei, in some sense, has sort of cheated a little bit to get to where it is, right? So there's sort of an underlying concern about Huawei on that front. And then there's the sanctions issue. So the arrest of CFO Meng didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, there have been long-standing concerns about both ZTE and Huawei supplying equipment to rogue states like Iraq and Iran over the last decade. So those issues have sort of coalesced around the company. And then there is this lingering fear about the origins of the company. Ren Zhengfei had some rank in the military. He was not a general, as some have asserted, but he came. A lot of Chinese companies, of course, people that formed early Chinese companies came out of the intelligence or the military. So there's this sort of lingering concern that because of the origins of the company, it was supported by the Chinese government. There were certain concessionary loans that were given to the company early on to nurture it, because China wanted to develop national champions in this space. They did not want to be dominated by Western companies. But what happened was, because of the support of the Chinese state in part, and the large domestic market that Huawei had access to, Huawei grew very rapidly as a company along with ZTE, while Western companies were subject to more to the whims of the market. And so over the last decade, there's no U.S. companies in this space now. So you had Motorola at one point, you had Nortel, a Canadian company with a big U.S. footprint. They've all sort of fallen by the wayside, Lucent. So what happened is we woke up one day and Huawei and ZTE were now huge players in the mobile space, and there were no other players in the U.S., for example. And then you basically had two European companies, Ericsson and Nokia, that were competing against these Chinese companies. So, and then you fast forward to 5G and all the concerns that I mentioned earlier. And so the focus of the U.S. concern centers around things like the Defense Department runs things like logistics networks on commercial mobile networks. So the big fear at the Pentagon is that if 5G is built with Huawei equipment or ZTE equipment, there's somebody sitting in Shenzhen with a big red button, and they can turn off the whole network just as the U.S. is ready to flow forces in to defend Taiwan. Those kinds of fears are certainly there in the U.S. system. And so that is in part driving this this concern over Huawei. And then there is the issue of, okay, Huawei equipment could be used to assist the Chinese government, for example, to launch cyber operations. So the other thing that's happened in the last decade is, particularly after the Google intrusions in the U.S. in 2000, is this huge concern over, 2010, is this huge concern over Chinese cyber theft of intellectual property.
Sure.
And even though that's happened without any Huawei equipment in the network, the fear is that with 5G and Chinese equipment everywhere, it'll be a little bit easier for the Chinese to demand that Huawei provide customer data.
It would happen faster and with lower latency.
right. So that all these concerns are sort of coalesced around this. And also, it's just at the time, of course, when there is a willingness of this administration to confront China across all these technology areas.
Right.
And that's really we can talk more about that. But there's a broader sort of technology fear of China's rise as a technology power.
Sam, what would you add to that?
On that point about the broader technology fear and Huawei being sort of a emblematic of that, there's one report that I keep coming back to, which is a DoD-sponsored report called the DIUX report. It came out a couple years ago, and I think this is really the narrative that's shaping when we talk about fears that Beijing is going to tell Huawei, push a button, and then this is going to take down networks around the world. It comes from an idea of the way that China's tech system works, where you have commercial companies that are beholden to direction from the party, right? And I think there are a lot of questions around to what extent companies actually push back. So this DIUX report came out while reform of the CFIUS process, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., the National Security Review of Inbound Foreign Investment. That's a totally separate issue from Huawei. But the reason I'm bringing them together right now is it's because of this sort of narrative about how the system works in China, which is to say that all commercial companies in some way are being directed from, you know, the Politburo or the Ministry of State Security, and that is the one objective. And I think that that narrative is part of why we're also viewing Huawei and a host of other Chinese tech companies in this light of being completely beholden to Beijing. You know, one thing that I think we also need to think about is what are the commercial global ambitions of these companies at the same time, and how do those interests intersect with pressures from the government at the same time? And there it's not always so straightforward.
Did the cybersecurity law have anything to do with this? China passing this law that a lot of American technology companies said really restricted their access to the market. Was this in some sense reciprocity for that? I mean, I know suspicions about Huawei much predate that, but do you think this was a catalyst for it?
I mean, the cybersecurity law, if you look at the enforcement actions that have been taken against that law so far, the vast majority of them are aimed at Chinese companies. They're not really, they haven't implemented it as much on foreign companies. And there are things like content violations and are you in violation of this very technical regulation called the multi-level protection scheme and securing critical infrastructure, which are sort of domestic cybersecurity issues, which is sort of a whole separate thread. So it's, I think a lot of these issues are getting bundled up together and creating this larger tech fear that Paul mentioned.
Yeah, I think on the cybersecurity law. I mean, the one area which I think there's some mirror imaging is on supply chain. So part of what also is driving this concern about Huawei is sort of general concern about U.S. ICT, information, computer technology, communications technology supply chains, which are largely centered on China, although not exclusively. And so the Huawei fits into that basket of concerns about U.S. supply chains. And the China cybersecurity law also has a big portion that's concerned about supply chains and for example, they have a cybersecurity review of network products and services. So they want to review any products that are going into critical information infrastructure in China. And that is sort of a mirror image of the U.S. concern about supply chains with Huawei.
Right,
so
right.
That's where the sort of the link, I think the linkage sort of resides. But definitely the law is now become part of the whole trade issue too, in terms of how China is dealing with data and dealing with things like cybersecurity.
Sam, Paul, I want to ask you a little bit about Huawei's corporate culture and a little bit about what we know today that we have been sort of scratching our heads about for a long time about the origins of the company, about Ren Zhengfei. I started covering Huawei way back. I was a technology reporter once upon a time. And in 2003, I think it was, I took a trip down to Shenzhen. I saw the famed Tower of 10,000 Engineers, where they proudly showed me how all the engineers had these bed rolls under their desks. They would sleep on the floor next to their desk, because they were working so hard. And, I was there on an employee intake day. It was fascinating because they had them all doing there's people do calisthenics. They shout these slogans. They had them in this sort of classroom where they were all, being subjected to this Huawei propaganda. I could see why, people made all sorts of comparisons to sort of, radical Maoism. there was kind of a cult of personality of the founder, although he was very mysterious. And, there were even back then, nobody was writing about Huawei without talking about how Ren Zhengfei was, a PLA officer. Nobody bothered to mention that he was like an extremely low-ranking communications engineer, but hey, whatever. I wonder, by the way, if we were to get rid of all former military brass in American telecommunications companies, how many we'd have left? Anyway, 15 years later, do we know better the actual extent of Ren or Huawei's links? But also, I want to get you guys to talk about, you took a trip there, right? You guys recently went to Zhejiang University, not to Huawei, but I think you guys you were together, right? You talked to...
Well, Paul's was at Huawei recently, but we did a separate trip to Zhejiang University where we met with a professor who had just written a book studying the management culture of Huawei.
Oh, yeah. Hey, so what did he have to say? That'd be really fascinating to hear.
So he described Huawei as... he said it's kind of like a car that's going 60 miles an hour on the highway and changing a tire at the same time, just to describe the fact that this company has been able to be sort of constantly innovating and reinventing itself over years to stay kind of at the forefront of commercial demand. And yeah, we've talked about Huawei potentially benefiting from IP theft with Cisco, state subsidies, but on top of that, you layer in this pretty innovative commercial approach at the same time. And I think you can't just say Huawei is only gotten to the sort of powerhouse position it is because of the state subsidies and IP theft. That's just part of the story. I think that there's this other layer on top, which is important. Sometimes when we talk, I said to Paul recently, it's like sometimes it's like we're talking about two separate companies when you hear the way that it's discussed in the media and in government circles in the US, and then the sort of Chinese corporate titan view. It's like, are we talking about the same company?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, and I think the part of the problem is transparency. So the company is not publicly traded. There's been a lot of efforts to do sort of due diligence internally to the company. You know, who owns the company? That Huawei says it's employee owned, but it's tricky because I think in the West we're used to companies of this size. This is a huge company, right? It's a global company with 180,000 people globally, and you know it's a $90 billion a year company. And so the fact is, not a lot is known still about the corporate governance and corporate structure and ownership structure. And so this also feeds into concern about the company. But I think Sam's point is really about the different views of the company being stark. I think that the real bifurcation is between the industry, the telecom industry, and the way Huawei is viewed, where again, it's viewed as a company that's providing innovative technology at relatively low cost and high performance. Regardless of its history, yes, there were all these issues back in the day, but I think it's generally regarded as a company that has matured. There's still some concerns about how it does business, of course, and the culture. That story on culture, by the way, always pops up like every year. I think I saw that first back in 15 years ago, with Penny Sender in Hong Kong. But I mean, it's an important part of the story, I think. But I think the way the company operates as a business is sort of opaque, and I think that generates a lot of concern. But within the industry, if you look at sort of the way it's viewed as in terms of its products and its commitment to service and how clients view it, then it has a much more positive reputation. Mm-hmm. But it's tricky because outside of that industry, people tend to read the media and they read stories about the company, and there isn't a whole lot of independent research. Now this company or this book that was written by the professor in Zhejiang University is part of a sort of a genre of literature that sort of a hagiography of Huawei touting innovation, and it's important. And they had real access to the company for I think 3 years, and so they got a really insider look and access to Ren Zhengfei, and they got all the, that book at least I think is probably the best look internally to the company, because it wasn't just a quick and dirty kind of like, Huawei is great as a national champion. It was an attempt to really get under the hood and what their management practices are and how they've succeeded in this very difficult and competitive market, global telecom market.
And I think it's not even just that, there's the industry view, and also a prime example, I got a phone call from my cousin a few months ago who lives in North Carolina, not far from Kaiser. And she said, she's a photographer in Durham. And she said, I want to buy a Huawei camera because they have a Leica lens. And a Leica lens is like this top-notch professional photographer lens. And she's like, this is the only handset I can get that has a Leica lens. This is amazing. Can I get it? And I said, yeah, get that phone. Why does the Chinese government want to spy on her? I don't know.
Because she's your cousin.
Right. Well, of course there's that.
So, speaking of these suspicions, Paul and Sam, you talked about the fear of a big red button that Huawei could give to the Communist Party to shut down whole networks. But even short of that, surely there are some legitimate national security concerns when it comes to Huawei. Even if they are a private company, it's very clear that if the party wants Huawei to do its bidding, there are limits to how much Huawei can push back, and that's the case for every Chinese technology company. Even if Snowden's revelations prove to Beijing that American companies can be used to spy with or without those companies' consent, that does not invalidate the American concerns, does it?
No, that's a very good point, Jeremy. I think absolutely there are concerns here. So but I think that the problem is that can't be looked at in isolation. So if you're again going back to the industry, carriers are very very aware of these kinds of concerns, right? And so carriers want to look at different vendors. So they value things like vendor diversity. So they want to be able to buy from different vendors. And then they're used to doing things like dealing with security of the whole network, right? And so they take that into account in the way they architect a network. And so, yes, there's always concern about what the government can do with a company and what they can order the company to do. So that could happen for any vendor. And of course, the closeness of in China, it's a little different because you have things like the national intelligence law, which says, I think in Article 7, something like, it's very vague though. It's in general, it says companies and individuals should cooperate with the government on intelligence work, right? Now, some have interpreted this as meaning that the Chinese government could order Huawei to participate in, offensive cyber operations. And I think that that's probably a reading a little bit too much into that, because, if the government really wants help from a company like Huawei, they don't need a law, first of all, to do that, right? And no country, I think, would pass a public law that says, your companies have to do this. So the problem with that view, though, is at stake is that Huawei is a global company, right, operating in 170 countries. And so if it became clear that Huawei was simply an arm of the Chinese government and was doing Beijing's bidding at every turn, then they wouldn't be able to operate as a global company. So that's the problem here is that the company is sort of forced to prove a negative, and it's really difficult. And so what I think has happened in response to that is, for example, in the UK and now in Germany, they've decided to sort of try to balance these legitimate security issues with the needs of the carriers and their desire to have access to cost-effective and high-performance equipment from different vendors. And so in the UK, they set up the Huawei Cybersecurity Center to review Huawei equipment and source code. They've been doing that for 7 years now.
But those are still UK. All Huawei employees, right?
But there are GCHQ, there are British government employees there that are all over the place. Also, absolutely. Okay. So in a sense, Huawei is opening up its source code to the British intelligence services of GCHQ, right?
Yeah.
And now Germany is in a particularly difficult situation because the German carriers have a big commitment to Huawei. So they've also set up a center in Bonn that's also reviewing, opening up Huawei source code to the German Federal Office for Information Security. And so the Germans have put out statements about this and say, look, we need proof of this. So we can't, if you're going to make us make a decision, for example, about who to include in our network architecture, they're essentially saying we're not going to accept at face value just that Huawei is a concern. We want proof of this. And right. In the meantime, we're going to go ahead and review, set up this security center and review Huawei source code so that we can have a balanced approach to carrier needs and to legitimate security concerns. And that's what the approach
has been taking. Is that effective, do you think?
Well, it's controversial. It's very controversial because it's very difficult, for example, to verify that what the software you're testing from Huawei headquarters in your center in the UK is exactly the same software that's being deployed by the carriers in their networks,
right,
on a day-to-day basis, because carriers opt for different features in the software, and so every carrier is running a different version of the software. So it's a problem of so-called binary equivalence. What is exactly the equivalence between what you're testing and what's running in the network? And the problem is, as you get to things like 5G, which is all about software, it's software in the cloud, it's software-defined networks, and it's AI, it's artificial intelligence algorithms that are controlling aspects of the network. So now it becomes much more difficult to try to use that approach and to really review all the software. Now you're talking about, millions and, lots of software code that has to be reviewed.
And so Paul, didn't the UK government come out recently, like in July, and it say, actually, there are some shortcomings around what we can actually verify. So what do you make of those? And I think it seems like that's a pretty big deal because we've been sort of, if we hold up this UK Cybersecurity Center as the model for, let's just take this model, beef it up, and maybe this can be used in a US 5G environment. So what do we make of the UK statements now?
Well, I think that those statements centered around things like binary equivalence, that it's really hard to establish that kind of binary equivalence because it requires you know, the company to then to do a lot of work to turn over specific kinds of software that it's deploying to a particular carrier. And every carrier is different. So then do you have to test the software for every carrier? So it's a big issue. And this costs money too, right? Who's going to pay for this, right? This is, there's also sort of a resource and
so short of issue. People starting to trust Huawei, there's not really anything that you can do that's 100%
foolproof. No, there's nothing. You can't guarantee security. So in a sense, the countries that are being asked to choose here, they're sort of faced with this really difficult dilemma. Do I go with, you know, what's likely to be more expensive equipment if I can't use Huawei? And it could be in some cases, you know, have less performance. It depends on the piece of equipment. Not always the case, because Huawei has a lot of experience and its equipment is very good in some cases. And how much has your security really gone up? Because the same vulnerabilities of 5G, it's subject to all the same cybersecurity vulnerabilities of any software and cloud-based kind of a network. And so are you getting a little bit of peace of mind because it's not Chinese equipment? But in a sense, the real difficulty is beyond sort of who makes the equipment. There's still all these vulnerabilities that you have to account for. And so the question is, you know, is that, for countries, that's a really difficult choice. I mean, it's not a clear choice. And also because there's no sort of clear evidence that Huawei is putting back doors in its equipment. The UK experience has not, you know, found any of that.
Interesting. Huawei seems to have, you know, an almost impossible public relations problem. And I mean, I think it's very easy to see why, Paul, you sometimes get into fights people attack you on Twitter, rather, because you say something about Huawei that is not critical. And any suggestion on the internet that maybe there are advantages to Google being in China is met with similar harsh criticism. But Huawei actually, they hired expensive communications and government relations lobbyists, K Street powerhouse firms, but it looks like they didn't really earn their keep. What do you know about Huawei's efforts in DC? And why does it seem that things have only gone from bad to worse for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, they've hired a lot of Western government relations officials.
They fired them recently.
Right. Well, in the U.S., you know, they for a long time they made a big effort to get into the U.S. market. They have research centers here in Texas and in California, and they fund research at universities here on wireless communications. So, you know, they for a long time have tried to break into the U.S. market, and you know they didn't really, I think, give up until more recently, when the sort of the pickup of the U.S. government sort of pushback on the company. And so I think that you know, in hiring Western faces to try to defend the company, you know, it's just been a really tough slog, because you're dealing with these some entrenched concerns about Huawei deep within the U.S. government and the military, it's hard for them to prove a negative. They just, you know, that's a public relations hurdle that's really hard to get over. How do you prove that you're not close you're not beholden to the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party? They can't simply walk in and order you to do something. It's really tough to you can't prove that. So the problem is, you're right. They really have a PR problem that is really impossible to overcome. So now I think they sort of realize this and they're pushing back on this. They're trying to, you know, they're lobbying heavily in Germany, for example, where they've had and in the UK where they've had some success in selling equipment. So I think they've given up on the US and the other Five Eyes to some degree, Canada. Maybe not yet Canada, but Australia certainly, and New Zealand. And then the really linchpin for them is Germany and the UK, because if those dominoes fall, then the EU essentially
it's interesting that becomes, you know, you say dominoes fall, yeah. Because I mean that's where I'm going with this next question. Right. You know, we've seen this growing chorus of rebuke. We've seen the US really pressure a lot of its allies, as you've said. We've seen, you know, Australia and New Zealand have already sort of joined in. Canada, well, you know, Canada's kind of tricky right now, given that they were, you know, involved in the detention, the arrest of Ren Zhengfei's daughter. But, you know, Deutsche, as you said, they're reviewing their telecoms vendor strategy. Huawei has, you know, spent all this money, as you say, on the cybersecurity center in the UK. But are we seeing something like a digital iron curtain descending? Sam, I mean, maybe, do you think that we're getting ahead of ourselves if we're saying this is the beginning of a new, genuine Cold War? What does that scenario look like, you know, if that really is the fact? I mean, if this is just like Winston Churchill, Fulton, Missouri, 1947, and the Iron Curtain, is there a digital curtain descending?
So I'm seeing two separate stories play out at once, right? If you just look at the government-to-government rhetoric, absolutely, this looks like a digital iron curtain. And I think that that is only getting worse. But let's just also remember that at the same time, we have U.S. companies that are continuing to operate over there, and new partnerships are being announced even regularly. You've got, you know, like Intel going in and doing more tie-ups with companies like Baidu and AI, and there's so that's not stopping. I think business is going on even as you have a kind of more hostile environment overall, and sort of the question is going to be where do these two things converge? I think that we also need to be, you know, cognizant of what are the downsides to this decoupling, right? What does that look like in an environment where you have research and investment and supply chains so tightly intertwined? There are going to be downsides from a U.S. competitive standpoint. There's going to be enormous cost unwinding those supply chains. And even from a national security view, if we say, you know, we're going to lose sight entirely of what China's doing in these emerging fields and get blindsided when they have a major breakthrough. Like, is that a good idea either? So I think even as this environment gets really tough, and I think it's going to continue to be that way, it's going to be important to kind of keep sight of where decoupling is going to be pretty devastating and may even be impossible in some areas to do.
Yeah. I would just add, I think, you know, the question is sort of how far to go and all these things. So when we try to describe what is the U.S.-China tech Cold War, which I have been using as a hashtag and I've gotten some pushback on, there's really three really large baskets here of issues, and some of them are short-term, some of them long-term. So the first one is the trade space, where a lot of the key concerns around the 301 investigation, like industrial policies, Made in China 2025, market access, cyber theft of IP, these are all centered on technology. Then the second basket is a sort of shorter, or a medium and longer-term problem, and that really centers on supply chains. And that's things like Huawei, it's things like the investment restrictions that Sam mentioned earlier for CFIUS, the export controls the U.S. is considering around emerging technologies like artificial intelligence, robotics and automation, and quantum computing, for example. And then the third basket is the sort of struggle for strategic long-term dominance of the technologies of the future. So they're AI, again, AI, quantum, supercomputing, and then you might even throw 5G into there, because these are long-term things that are going to extend out to, you know, for a decade at least. So the problem is as Sam mentioned, there's this tight coupling in some of these areas between China. So the question is, how far do you decouple before you start having effects that are really negative? So everybody is sort of, there's a general agreement that maybe China, there are too many supply chains in China. So yes, maybe the U.S. companies should diversify and do this. But the problem is, for 30 years, companies have been told, optimize your supply chains and go to places like China where there has been cheaper, for example, labor. But now it's really more about skilled labor, not about cheaper labor. It's about skilled engineers. Foxconn can build a facility to build iPhones in Zhejiang and easily find 30,000 engineers to staff it up. But when they go to Wisconsin, they have a lot of problems, right? So it's not so some supply chains can be modified or moved, but some of them are really just difficult because all these things are available in Asia. All these high-end products around smartphones, for example, the whole smartphone supply chain is in Asia. It's not anywhere else. A smartphone is a perfect example of sort of the globalization of the high-tech sector, and that could only be built in China unless you want to pay, you know, $5,000 for your iPhone. So
is this suicidal? I mean, what America is doing right now,
given this lead in supply chain.
Right. Well, we at Eurasia Group, we're grappling with this idea of next year of one of our top risks. So we every year we do top risk. I'm giving a little bit of a preview view here. I hope I don't get in trouble. But we're worried about next year what we call innovation winter, because the problem is that as you take into account all these different things happening, decoupling of supply chains, restrictions on STEM visas, restrictions around investments and export controls on really cutting-edge technologies. If you put all this together, companies are making decisions. They're putting money, instead of an innovation, they're building a factory in Malaysia to so they don't have to pay tariffs, you know, on goods going to the U.S. So all this sort of saps a lot of the resources and energy out of what has been a very innovative supply chain, with China is part of it, right? I mean, Qualcomm and Broadcom generate huge amounts of revenue from China, and that goes into their innovation because they're innovating for the China market. So if those things start breaking down, then the question is, you know, some of the U.S.'s most innovative companies, are they going to be able to be as innovative in this new environment? And are they, you know, are all these things going to add up to what we call innovation winter? So I think that's the downside. So the question is sort of how far these things go and what happens out of the trade negotiations coming. Can we get back to some sort of engagement with China that also addresses some of these very legitimate concerns over market access? You know, these are big issues for U.S. companies.
Sam, what do you think of this idea of an innovation winter? I mean, we've had this delightfully fruitful period of cross pollination between the Valley and Beijing, and with all of our wonderful gadgets being assembled in Shenzhen, you know, where the entire supply chain is. What happens now? I mean, is this innovation winter a coming? Is winter coming?
So this is where I want to go back to that report I brought up earlier, the DIUX report. Uh-huh. And I can't really harp on this enough. I feel like we're in this moment where DOD is driving the narrative around global trade and investment. And I get it. National security is vital. And I don't want anyone to say that that's not something that I value, right? But should that be the sort of driving force behind the way that we're looking at innovation and trade? I don't think that they should be in the driver's seat on that. And that's kind of the problem, is it's a misfit.
Right. It seems like a short-sighted view of what national security constitutes. I mean, this is ultimately, I think, damaging to national security.
Well, I think the pendulum is always kind of swinging back and forth. And what's happened is, under the, for example, the U.S. national security strategy that came out earlier in the year, there was this new concept of the national security innovation base. And, you know, that's a really interesting concept to get your head around. So that means that innovation in the U.S. is somehow now really wrapped up with national security. Right, right. So that accounts for example, artificial intelligence and robotics and automation and quantum sciences being included in this emerging technologies a list, for example, that Commerce put out last month, and an attempt to sort of gain control of the direction and how those sectors develop and what is allowed to be exported or not. So I think that's sort of a paradigm shift, and I think industry is still trying to adjust to that. Where they want to understand, they understand national security concerns. This has always been a concern in the U.S., but they want to understand what those boundaries are and how far those boundaries are going to be pushed, because they are concerned that it's going to result in a degradation of investment, or in their ability, for example, to decide they want to invest in China in a joint venture, but they're going to be transferring technology, and that's going to be a concern suddenly to the U.S. government and impede their ability to expand, for example. So we're in a sort of a the eye of the hurricane here. Sam and I have talked about this, where we don't really know how far some of these things are going to go in terms of, is it going to be a worst case scenario where we get an innovation winter? Is there going to be some pulling back, some agreement between the two sides as a result of the trade negotiations that leads us, you know, on a less dire path?
I've argued for, I wrote an article in Foreign Affairs with my colleague Loran Laskai earlier this fall, and we argued for something called this small yard, high fence approach, which isn't our phrase. I think this was former Secretary of Defense Gates first used this. Anyway, the idea is figure out what do you need to protect, define that in precise terms, and then build defenses around that rather than using this blunt instrument that kind of sweeps up everything. And I think that's the idea here. You know, Paul and I are not saying that these national security concerns are not valid. They absolutely are, but can we be more targeted when we're identifying what they are? So when we look at, you know, Paul mentioned the new export controls and expands expanded lists around what falls under technologies related to national security. So as we're going through that list and we're trying to figure out, okay, how do we identify what those technologies are that we need to put, be more cautious about in terms of who has access to what in, you know, in kind of global trade and investment world. How do we whittle that down? And I don't think that's an easy task, but I think as long as we're getting input from, you know, not just the sort of DoD lens, but it's this broader view with an eye to balancing the innovation and understanding that US power is also for decades has been defined by our ability to compete and be innovative, and that also is a part of that. So how can we take a small yard, high fence approach to pinpointing where the concerns are?
I really like that, small yard, high fence. I think that's a terrific concept.
So, I mean, essentially you're saying the problem is similar to the general economic issue with China, that there is a lot of there are many problems in China and America's economic relationship, but many people think that tariffs are the worst possible way of solving them. There's a genuine concern with Huawei. That's not in dispute, right. But the current methods are scattershot and are not effective and threaten to disrupt American business and innovation. Would that be a good summary?
Yeah, and I think even that small yard high fence view can be applied to Huawei. I mean, Paul, you've talked to me about the idea that we need to distinguish between a handset and, you know, having Huawei equipment in the core network backbone. Do you want to talk a bit about that? Because I think that's a good illustration of that concept applied to Huawei.
Well, yeah. When you talk to carriers, for example, they've heard from the U.S. government officials that they're worried that if there's too many Huawei handsets, it can all be used as a botnet to, you know, to take down something. So, and carriers, you know, they have a lot of experience with these kinds of things, and they sort of say, we know how to handle that. That's not really a concern. So the handset is one thing. Now, the problem is, of course, handsets are getting more capable. There are AI algorithms on the handset. And so in general, there's sort of a huge capability increase in edge devices like handsets. But in general, the core of the network is really the concern, because that would be where, you know, an intelligence service would want to exploit something in the core of the network. So, you know, that and that's, for example, what France has done. France has kept Huawei out of the core of the network, but they allow Huawei equipment in the radio access part of the network, for example. So you can make these kinds of distinctions about where you allow equipment, depending on your level of concern about a country of origin of equipment. Or you can architect the network architecture to build in more security and try to, you know, mitigate some of these concerns also. So it's a tricky thing with 5G because it's so, as I mentioned earlier, it's so complicated. And I think a lot of people don't really understand what it is, you know, what is 5G on the policy side. So we've done a white paper, which I'll recommend, which is trying to lay out sort of the geopolitics of 5G.
What's the title of that?
It's called The Geopolitics of 5G. Ah. So, and it's up on the EG website, and it's an attempt to capture some of this, and it talks about standards and talks about national policies around 5G, and tries to you know bring a little clarity to some of these issues, which you see sometimes reported in the media, and they tend to repeat some of the memes that are not quite accurate. And this is an attempt to clarify some of that.
Well, we'll put a link to that in there. One last question for both of you, and that is, you know, I think Sam's offered some very useful suggestions, and so have you, Paul. But what is general? What's the way back from this? What are the forces that are keeping this from, you know, passing the point of no return if we're not already there yet, and might be able to pull us back to sort of sanity on these issues? Not just Huawei, but just more on what you've been calling the technology cold war.
Well, let me just, this is a really tough question, but I think that there you have to sort of step back and talk about, you know, what other factors are driving the broader U.S.-China sort of confrontation. And there, of course, there's a lot of issues. The U.S. And others, the U.S. business community, and now more and more the U.S. government have basically decided that in China, the process of reform and opening that had been unfolding under previous Chinese leaders before Xi Jinping. Chinese history didn't start with Xi Jinping, but there's a perception that Xi has taken China in a different direction, and a more authoritarian direction, less market mechanisms, et cetera. And so that there's a feeling that the dynamic that had that sort of positive process that had been unfolding prior to Xi is now sort of inexorably going in another direction. And so that's sort of the underlying factor behind things like the Pence speech at the Hudson Institute, right? Basically, that the party is in control here. and that the Chinese system is evolving in a way that is sort of diametrically opposed to the U.S. right, system.
Expanding values gap.
Right, and there's no, it's about trust. So there's no trust essentially between the two systems. China has gone from being a stakeholder under the Obama administration, a stakeholder in the international system, to being an adversary essentially. And so that dynamic is really tough to separate, and that's what's sort of driving the tech issues. And so until there's improvement in that, until we sort of get back to some level of engagement, we sort of dug this deep hole. I think what I see is that the current negotiations, if they're dug us out of that hole, so now there is some engagement, but there's still no trust, right? I mean, so what could come out of the trade negotiations would be a sense of trying to build some trust going forward. But it's really tough because all these issues are going to get, you know, they're going to continue to polarize the debate in both countries.
Sam, what do you have to add to that?
Oh, gosh, I don't even know. I mean, I think I just feel like we're kind of headed over a cliff right now. And you know, and even the fact that we're having this conversation where we're sort of taking this, what I think is a more balanced look at Huawei, but knowing that there will be people in the audience who will say, oh, we're just being naive about the national security concerns and apologizing for China and you're a panda hugger, reference to your last podcast on blaming China. Like, are we panda huggers because we're trying to take a more holistic small yard high fence approach here? No, I don't think so. But we need to be able to at least have an environment where it's okay to have these more kind of nuanced discussions without it being a black and white issue is the first step. I noticed last week that I think the rotating chairman of Huawei held a press conference, which was kind of unusual in that he actually accepted questions from the journalists in the audience. So more of this kind of thing, and you know, Kaiser, with your background, you can probably comment on the communication strategies involved there. But I think as there's so much suspicion about our Chinese companies, particularly in the tech sector, beholden to orders from Beijing, you know, the extent to which they can kind of show that they're willing to be more transparent about the very concerns that the U.S. is talking about is going to be helpful for having those conversations. So more of that.
Yeah.
Sam, that makes me laugh a little. In 2012, Kaiser and I recorded a podcast with Will Moss, who at the time was doing communications for Motorola in China, and David Wolf, who is a very experienced telecom and media consultant, I guess, now in America, but he used to live in Beijing. And the conversation was about why Huawei's reputation is so bad and what exactly is Huawei. And I remember at one point screaming at the microphone, you know, Ren Zhengfei, if you're out there, come out of your cave, or something like that. anyway, he didn't come out of his cave in 2012, and I can't see that happening.
Yeah.
Alas. Well, guys, unbelievably fun conversation with you both, and, you know, worrisome, but thanks so much for taking the time to come to talk to us, both of you. Let's go on to recommendations. Before we do that, I do want to quickly remind our listeners that the Cynical Podcast is powered by SupChina. If you enjoy the Cynical Podcast and all the other shows in our network, like the Fantastic Tech Buzz and Ta for Ta, and if you enjoy the wide-ranging content on SupChina, then the best thing you can do is to sign up for SupChina Access, where your support will help to make all of this possible into the future. We can keep bringing you the reporting, the conversations, and the videos, all that stuff that you like. Now, on to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off. What do you have first?
Okay, I have small kids, so I read a lot of Dr. Seuss books.
As one does. Yeah.
And there's one that I had never heard of that I acquired called You're Only Old Once, A Book for Obsolete Children. And on the back it says, is this a children's book? Well, not immediately. You buy a copy for your child now and you give it to him on his 70th birthday. So it's basically about getting old and falling apart. It's very funny.
It's appropriate for me then.
Yeah, well, hey.
Jeremy, last time you saw me, you said, Kaiser, your whiskers are very silver. It's very true.
That's true. That's true.
I shaved them
but
all
I was
off,
thinking yeah. more about me being the one falling apart in recommending this book.
Sam, what do you have for us this week?
So I'm watching the Netflix remake of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and it's incredible. It's for grown-ups. It's very creepy. It's dark. It's dark humor, and it's incredibly well done. It has, as Sabrina, the actress that played Sally in Mad Men, and she's grown up and fantastic.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you know, I've actually heard, this is you're like the third person to say really good things about that show. Okay, that's, you know, third time's charm. I'm gonna put that on my watch list for sure then. Thanks. Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Wow.
Wow, that kind of blows my mind, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Paul, you're up. What do you have?
Well, is it too cynical for me to propose the Kai-Fu Lee's book, The AI Superpowers?
Oh, no.
Because I think, I think a lot of people maybe have just read the dust jacket, but I think it deserves a little more careful read because it's sort of, some of these issues that we've talked about are in there, but it's also sort of a human story about his journey from, you know, sort of high-level executive and work-driven to sort of some of the human aspects and concern about AI and automation and how it's going to affect societies in the future. So it has a lot of, it sort of runs the gamut of, you know, all these issues we've discussed, and but then, you know, I got AI and then sort of the human element that he brings into it very well. So I recommend a close read of that. I think a lot of people, as I say, I think maybe just skim it, but I think it's a very thoughtful
it's not to be skimmed. I think there are a couple of things, and besides the human story, I think the things that I took away from it, first of all, just a great history of internet entrepreneurship in China. Exactly. I mean, it's just one of the best, most readable histories of it. Right. Secondly, this sort of conceptual idea of why Chinese data is so qualitatively different than the data that American companies, this sort of going heavy versus going light dichotomy that he draws. I thought that was extremely eye-opening for me. I thought it was just, a really good book.
Kaiser, I agree with you about everything in the book, but the data argument, and maybe this is a subject for another podcast that we should do.
Yeah, we should talk data. Yeah.
We need a whole podcast on data, because I think that the way that Kai-Fu Lee characterizes China's AI advantage because of the access to data is not... I disagree with it. I think that they...
I think
it might mean that maybe Chinese AI companies are going to be really good at, you know, tailoring their algorithms to the needs of Chinese teenagers and what they're buying online. But I don't know how that translates outside of China in terms of the type of data that they have access to.
He said the same thing when we asked him about that. Does that necessarily translate? No, it's basically for China, right? But yeah, and your proposal is accepted. I've actually recently invited you to come on for a live show, and we'll hold you to that and make sure that data is part of that conversation.
Thank you. That sounds great.
My recommendation is actually for a rare thing. It's directly related to our conversation right now. It was an op-ed in the Washington Post by the UPenn scholar Scott Moore, who is director of UPenn's China Center. It's a piece about Huawei. It's called The Huawei Fallout Leaves Companies and Countries with an Impossible Choice. It's very good. I highly recommend it. It's a nice short op-ed, but I think it gives you a lot to think about. So again, thanks so much for coming on. I mean, Sam, it was great to talk to you, and I'm really looking, you're heading down here in a couple of days, and we're going to go out and eat Chinese food on Christmas Day, right?
I'm so excited. Yeah. Bringing my 5-year-old and all of his crazies down.
Cool. All right.
I want to get in on that one.
Well, you go. Come on down. Jeremy, man, great to talk to you as always.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Paul.
Good thoughtful questions, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn and edited by Jason McRonald and me. Special thanks this week to Jim Millward, who was kind enough to let us convert his dining room into a makeshift studio. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Tyson Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Plus China, New Voices, China Econ Talk, and Top for Top. More great shows coming soon, really soon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.